On Monday, June 3rd, we talked to an expert on Israeli politics regarding what's ahead for Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Also, Stratford Republican State House candidate Jim Feehan chatted with us about his disputed election loss this past November. And we wrapped up the show with an expert about keeping tobacco products and vaping products away from anybody under 21 years old. Politics in Israel, always interesting. And it looks like a second election may be needed after Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu failed to form a new government. And joining us right now is Michael Friedson, the co-founder and executive editor of the MediaLine News Agency. And he has more than two decades of experience covering the Middle East and Israel. And he calls us and joins us now from Israel. Michael, Paul Pacelli here. How are you? It's nighttime where you are, right? Good evening.
Yes, it is. 10:30 in the evening.
Well, I tell you, this is interesting now that Mr. Netanyahu, he won a very contested election, another, you know, nail biter on the end. But what's the problem now? He can't get a coalition government together?
Well, that's the problem as it stands at the moment. In Israel, the way it works is there's two things you got to do if you want to be prime minister. You don't just grow up and want to be it and then get appointed or anything. Mm-hmm. You have to first be the head of a party that gets the most number of seats in the parliament when you have an election. It's not over then either, because after you obtain that position, the president, which is normally a ceremonial job, but he's got to work at election time, he's got to be convinced that you're able to come up with the 61-plus seats in the legislature in order to successfully put together a coalition. Now, the horse trading that goes on is unbelievable. The currencies that are exchanged are committee chairmanships, deputy committee chairmanships, deputy ministries, full ministries, whatever, anything it takes to convince the guy that needs your seats to make his coalition is pretty much goes down to the 11th hour. This time, though, the guy didn't blink. A guy named Avigdor Lieberman, who used to be defense minister, walked out on this current government. He, by the way, started his career after moving to Israel from Moldova when it was still the former Soviet Union. His first job was to be a bureau chief for Benjamin Netanyahu. And they've had a kind of love-hate relationship ever since. But he was supposed to blink. Everybody blinks at the last minute and takes the best deal they can get, and they move on. This is the first time they went to what they're calling a snap election, and because Netanyahu couldn't put the coalition together, they're going to do the whole rerun over again, which doesn't have too many people too happy about it, except the guys that came in short the last time. They think they can do better. Enter fate again, though. Netanyahu is not someone to be dealt lightly when you're running against him and it looks grim and gloomy for him. Mm-hmm. He actually, in the first polling that's come out since the announcement that there'll be a snap election on September 17th, the first polling that comes out broke the tie. Netanyahu is no longer, according to the poll, equal 35 seats with the second party that would have taken over. But now he's up to, they're down to, a net of four for Netanyahu, so he's soaring.
You know, he, Michael Friedson, he is a fascinating study. You know, he's got 9 lives. The guy's got 15 lives. He is, I think his run now as prime minister, especially if he wins again, you know, would be unprecedented. I do know folks who have, who grew up in Israel, who have relatives there. I see these people on a regular basis, and we talk about this, and it really is a fascinating dynamic of a guy who, you know, every 2 or 4 years, depending upon how often these elections come up, you know, Benjamin Netanyahu was always counted out. Oh, this time he's going down. Forget it. It's all over. He's too close to Trump. He's too close to Bush, this and that. And the guy always, at least, Michael, in the short term, seems to survive.
Well, he does survive. He has an unbroken chain of 10 years behind him and another term that he was defeated after before that.
Yeah.
If he is the prime minister through the month of July, he will beat out the legendary David Ben-Gurion, mm-hmm. founding prime minister of the country, for longevity.
It's interesting, and Michael Friedson is the guest, co-founder and executive editor of the MediaLine News Agency. Michael, it's interesting. A dear friend of mine who is Jewish and I work with, who has family over there, we were talking about this a few months ago, and I'd love to get your thoughts on this. And we were talking about this, and he said, you know what? He said, going back to the raid on Entebbe, he said, and knowing that many Jewish leaders also have outstanding military backgrounds, he said the Netanyahu name and what his brother did, he was killed tragically during that rescue raid of the hostages, he said that holds still a lot of cachet with the Israeli electorate.
Well, the name Netanyahu is huge in Israel for many, many, many years. His father, who passed away only a couple years ago, I think it was almost 100, if not 100, was a noted historian, a very activist family. His father goes back to the group of right-wingers who were key in the founding of the state. Then he came up through the ranks diplomatically. He came to the scene as a young guy. He got a gig as the, I think it was first the deputy ambassador at the UN, and he just set New York on fire.
Michael, you were going to make a couple of points here about the Netanyahu legacy in general. Go ahead.
Well, first of all, I suggest often to people, when you're looking at where the guy ranks in the world, how many heads of government can you throw the name out and perhaps the countries, but not in order of who are the heads of government, and invariably someone's going to recognize the name Netanyahu and associate it with Israel. That's a tremendous part of the legacy right there. Then for Israelis, it's not lost that it's their prime minister who probably only among anybody else, any other country, he has the ability to pick up the phone with the left hand and speak to Putin, pick up the phone with the right hand and speak to Trump, and he's part of that conversation. And he has that kind of accessibility and familiarity, which is really unprecedented.
That is...
In 2015...
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
When he was running in 2015, he was supposed to lose also. It was one of those squeakers. And our agency was the only one really that said, no, he's got this beat.
Why? Really? Really? Why did you make that determination?
Well, it was actually, for us, it was pretty simple. There's two questions that pollsters ask. The first one is meaningless. Who are you going to vote for? Mm-hmm. People lie. You can't get a straight answer. It doesn't really matter what they say. You can bend the figures to fit what you want. But the second question was, who do you feel is the one capable, not that you like the most, but the most capable to have their finger on the button at this time when you got 150,000 rockets pointed down your throat from the north and another some tens of thousands pointed from the south? Who do you really want there? And when people go into the voting booth, that's the moment of honesty. They vote health and wealth, and they vote for Netanyahu for virtually each time. And I think what we're seeing in this first poll out after the collapse of the new government, the nascent government, I think we're seeing that already perhaps beating them to the voting booth.
Michael, I saw a fascinating article. I don't know whether it was in Haaretz or the Jerusalem Post, or I read it somewhere. It was party to what you were saying. Why does Netanyahu keep winning? And the politics I saw, and you may have seen this, the analysis of the Jewish voter in Israel is fascinating, because here in the States, you obviously know most people, the trend here is you grow up as a liberal, a progressive, and then a certain percentage will become conservative as they get older. And this fascinating story showed the data that it's the complete reverse in Israel, which is why they think Netanyahu survives so often, is that many young people in Israel grow up with conservative leanings, and as they get older, they tend to not like the situation on the West Bank with the Palestinians and ever, and then they turn to a little bit more of a progressive style. So the young voters actually, as opposed to here, gravitate more toward, you know, conservatism and Netanyahu. I found that a fascinating analysis.
Well, Netanyahu also is a bit of an enigma in that sense as well. You remember when Richard Nixon ran for re-election in 72? He won in a huge landslide, but you couldn't find anybody on the street who said they voted for him. And Netanyahu is quite a bit on that mold as well.
Yeah, and you're right. And, you know, people, and again, the election here, President Trump 2.5 years ago, the statisticians all admit there was, as you say, there was a hidden vote in there that, you know, a lot of people lie. And it's sad, Michael, but, you know, in your business, my business, I've known pollsters, you do your own polling. Some people, for whatever reason, do not feel comfortable sharing that information.
Yeah, you know, the credo of those of us who are strange enough to go into journalism and stay in journalism and not drip over into advocacy. You want the truth out. You want the realistic stuff out, because you can't do planning for yourself. You can't be a strategist.
Mm-hmm.
You can't do almost anything if you're not honest with yourself first and with the people you're working for next.
Michael Friedson, the guest here on Connecticut Today, the co-founder and executive editor of the Media Line News Agency in Israel, covering Israel and the Middle East. Back to a couple of things you mentioned earlier, Michael, the opposition, the butting of the heads, if you will, between Benjamin Netanyahu, who is by all measure a conservative leader, and Avigdor Lieberman, who has caught a lot of heat in the past for, you know, wanting, I think it was loyalty oaths from Arabs living in Israel. Has he moderated? Has he become more conservative? What is his standing along with the actual numbers you gave me before? What's the dynamic with him right now?
Well, a lot of people wanted to write him off as an opinionated, idealistic, someone who doesn't share the values of a democratic country, coming from the former Soviet Union as he did. But he was one of the modern first conservative leaders. Certainly his party and his beliefs were conservative. What was really interesting about him is he is so easy, because of what he says and how he says it, to simply write him off as an anti-democratic nutcase. But he's not at all. He's a very bright man.
Mm-hmm.
He believes in what he speaks about. And a lot of what he says, if you get past the rhetoric, or you get past the theatrics of this guy speaking like that, listen to what he's saying. Well, if you really listen to what he's saying, it resonates with a lot of people. He's not favoring throwing people out of the country. He's not in favor of locking people up for the wrong reasons. And if you dig deep enough, you can see that his views are carefully thought out and actually pretty well expressed. That bothers a lot of people. Now, would he in this particular instance, though, he's a bargainer. He sits at the table, looks him in the eye, and he's playing hardball. And he parlayed a party that went from about 9 or 10 seats in the last government. In this election, they were down to 5 seats. And he went up against Netanyahu, who was playing with a deck of 35. And he not only stared him down, but he got Netanyahu to fold and the whole government to fold with him. He's definitely someone to be reckoned with. He's not crazy. He's not a right-wing Neanderthal monster in any way. He just may be a little more conservative in his leanings. But if you cover any government, especially a democratic government, from the perch of journalism, you see all these things, and you have to appreciate where the strengths are and where the weaknesses come in.
Michael, what do Israelis think of President Trump?
Well, that's an easy one. On the whole, he's very, very popular here, perhaps more popular here than in his own country, which is interesting too, because they say the same thing of Benjamin Netanyahu,
mm-hmm.
that he has a lot of trouble getting elected here, which of course pales when you're talking about the office you're elected to, being the prime ministership. But when he goes to America, everybody's convinced that he could easily be elected to the Senate or higher. In terms of the other way around, the Israelis love theater. The Israelis love the outrageous. And they are very, very much impressed with the way President Trump is spontaneous, that you don't know what's coming next, that he relies on something like social media, where others would be more conservative and less likely to be as unruly, if we can say that, with the clicker and with his cell phone.
Yeah.
And on the whole, now, then, of course, you have to factor in the part of the country that is very much grateful for the move of before the move of the embassy, the recognition of Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. That's an issue that transcended politics. You'll find people who are on the far left who don't agree with anyone on the right on anything. Everybody was grateful that this historic anomaly was corrected, and that the United States, the closest ally, the most important ally Israel has, had no problem looking at the world and saying that, yes, Jerusalem is the capital of the state of Israel. And, of course, moving the embassy just followed from there.
And now, yet here,
said all of that.
And yet here in the U.S., he was, you probably read, he was pilloried by many on the left here, including, Michael, you may have seen a lot of liberal American Jewish leaders who have a completely different outlook on this president.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Politics in America is very much along religious lines, mm-hmm. perhaps now more so than in some recent years. The Jewish community in America is overwhelming. It's 80% the Democrat, and they'll pretty much support the candidate, whoever the candidate is. It'll be interesting to see how they choose from 20 or more candidates.
Yeah.
That'll be of interest. But that's the way it is, and the Israelis basically appreciate that. I have to tell you, as a journalist working out of Israel, and we're contacted every day by different news organizations around the world, I think one of the most frequently asked questions, without a doubt, is that question, like, why do you feel the American Jewish community is so overwhelmingly pro-Democrat? And it's when you get past the letters DNA, it's kind of hard to explain.
Yeah. I did actually, Michael, read something once, and I don't remember who it was. But one theory was a Jewish political scientist living in Israel, and he said, you know what? He said he thinks one theory that he postulated was that it goes back a long way to a lot of the social workers in the early 60s who went to the American South to help black Americans here gain their civil rights. And it's obviously we know some of those Jewish volunteers were brutally murdered. And there is a refusal here by many in the Jewish community who vote Democrat to separate the Old South and the New South, which is, you know, overwhelmingly Christian and deep supporters of, you know, of Israel from a biblical sense. And that and there is that just that disconnect that has kept many Jewish voters, you know, as you say, 70 or 80% in the Democratic column.
Yeah, there's another element, too. Franklin Delano Roosevelt was hugely, hugely popular amongst the Jewish community.
Mm-hmm.
It was only after the war that some things came about and it became known that he wasn't as forthcoming in certain instances where Jews could have been saved from Hitler had he acted differently. But on the whole, he was extremely, extremely popular amongst the Jewish community. And a lot of the support that the Democrats are still receiving from the Jewish community date back to that era.
Sure.
Date back to family heritage where, you know, you grow up in a home where you worship Franklin Delano Roosevelt. It becomes part of the family history and part of the credo of the family, and it just passes on from generation to generation.
Michael, in about the 90 seconds we have left, quickly, a issue that never seems to go away, the threat, most people would say, and to some degree from Iran in the Middle East, the rhetoric that still goes on pointed at Israel. What's the temperature on that right now as we speak, Michael?
Oh, pretty darn hot. The reason that Iran is so insidious is because they have so many proxy terrorist organizations. And if you look at every hotspot in the Middle East, you'll see the fingerprints of Iran behind it. There is really nobody criticized Benjamin Netanyahu, even the people that politically were his enemies. They did not criticize him for going to the mattresses as he did to defeat the nuclear bill with Iran.
Interesting. Michael, thank you. Michael Friesen, co-founder and executive editor of the Media Line News Agency. You can check out the Media Line's highly acclaimed Mideast Daily News. Michael, it's been a pleasure. Thank you, and we'll keep you on the roster, and we will check back with you often if you can. We appreciate it.
Oh, I'd love it. Happy to do it.
All right. Thank you, Michael. Appreciate it. Have a wonderful evening there. Live from Israel, Michael Friedson, co-founder and executive editor of the Media Line News Agency. Well, there you go. There is the disconnect, and that's exactly what it is, folks. There is the disconnect of the belief or the opinion that Israel has of Jews living in Israel in the Middle East versus American Jews and how they vote. Complete bipolar, 180-degree difference on the opinion of Republicans and President Trump. Jim Feehan is the guest. He ran on the Republican ticket for a legislative seat last November, lost by 13 votes to incumbent Representative Phil Young of Stratford. We're talking about District 120 there. And Jim, welcome to WICC. How are you?
Good, Paul. How about yourself?
Not too bad, not too bad. Boy, what a saga this is. You lost by 13 votes in the district. But what happened, Jim? Some people may not be following this. Some have, obviously. What happened after an investigation was initiated into what went on at Bunnell High School?
Well, very simply, the ballots, one of the people working there, I believe a young high school student, reached and took, by error, as best we can tell, the wrong ballots. And approximately 76 ballots were given out that were meant for the 122nd district were given to voters in the 120th. With that also being, so those votes were miscast from the 120th into the 122nd. So basically there's 76 votes missing from our election, which obviously this election becomes a tainted or botched election, if you would.
Now, was Bunnell a polling spot for both districts, the 120 and the 122?
It was.
Oh, no
it
wonder.
It was for both.
Okay,
yeah.
All right.
And the bad part is that was my highest polling district, where I carried the district by about 59.6%. You know, there's been conjecture back and forth based off of ABs, but it was my highest polling district.
Okay, so you, at least at that point, you lose the race. You lost by 13 votes in the race. You lost that to Phil Young, the incumbent a Democrat there from Stratford. So you raise the specter here of saying, hey, wait a minute, I, lack of a better term here, I got screwed. You know, no offense to the young person working the ballots, but you got to have the right ballots here. So you raise this and you hand it over to the legislature to look at or decide. What happens then?
Well, we went through, actually, we don't agree. Matter of fact, there's a little bit more history behind it, is that
sure.
Judge Bellis out of Superior Court in Bridgeport agreed with us and put a temporary injunction, which is very extremely hard to get. However, the Supreme Court overturned her injunctions, then saying that the right currently sits with the House. And that the Constitution of the State of Connecticut says that the House has the sole right to decide a contested election. So this is a contested election by myself and others as well. There was one other candidate in the race. So we've been waiting now since November, and the House came into order in January, and they've refused to do anything.
So they simply have said, what, don't look at us to weigh in on this, even though you've petitioned them to do it? I mean, what's the, do they have, Jim, a structured process to do anything here? Or are they just trying to make it up as it goes along? I know Majority Leader Matt Ritter has been vocal about this.
Well, Matt Ritter, unfortunately, is nothing more than a partisan hack. And I'm happy to say that, because he doesn't care about free and open elections. He cares about maligning the truth so that they keep their majority, and has completely ignored this election and the town of Stratford. And what's happened here is the Democrats have decided they have the majority in the House by 90 to 50, a really large majority. At the end of the day, they've decided that they would rather run out the clock to keep their supermajority and not do what's right by Stratford and elections. This is clearly a botched election. Ritter, the House Speaker, and also Mr. Young have decided that, you know, they don't want to have a fair election.
Now, you were represented by an attorney in Hartford. That attorney argued in the petition that the U.S. Supreme Court should have a say in this. Talk about your appeal to the High Court.
Well, I'll tell you, Paul, we didn't want to do this. We tried to take the gentleman in the high approach to this in the high road. We waited to as long as possible to filing with the Supreme Court. There's a filing deadline. That's why we couldn't wait until the end of session for them to take it up in October if they decide to. The whole process is based upon what we believe, that the courts should have had dominion over this, because look what's happened. Their attorney was a gentleman named Bill Bloss, who argued that why would we think that the majority wouldn't do the right thing and correct this election? So going to the base of your question, there's a haphazard committee that very rarely formed, and this committee was put together, and they came out with a split decision. The funny thing is they came out with a split decision, but they all agreed on the facts, that this election was botched, it shouldn't be counted, but they couldn't get together as to how to solve this. The two Republicans on board wanted a full new election, and the two Democrats on board said that they wanted just to revote Bunnell. I agreed to that. I was happy to do that.
Uh-huh.
At least then we could settle this. But it came out with a split decision, and then somewhere along the lines, the Democratic majority decided, well, we don't think we really want to do anything. So that's why we had to go to SCOTUS.
So somebody, and this is not you saying this, Jim, I'm going to say this, somebody pulled somebody out back through the back door, if you know what I mean, and said, no, you don't want to go down this route. No. I mean, that's what it sounds like to me. Somebody pulled rank here.
Well, I think you have a supermajority by one party rule. This should have never occurred. Now, imagine if the roles were reversed. I would have been in a new election by the House convened on January 6th or whenever it was.
Yeah.
The next day, they would have ordered a new election if the roles were reversed. And the problem here is that not only did someone pull someone back to the woodshed and say, hey, we don't want to vote this, you guys don't want to do this, they also had two of their representatives with clear-cut conflicts of interest, Mr. Young and Mr. Blumenthal, vote on the measure not three times not to have a new election or some type of legislation that would drive that. The first one was an amendment that the House Republicans tried to put into place to allow a new election in the 120th, and Mr. Young actually voted against it, and so did Mr. Blumenthal, who's employed by the attorney. That's the firm that Mr. Bloss works with.
So Matt
Blumenthal
voted against it, and he works for the same law firm that whose lawyer is representing Phil Young and the Democrats.
That would be a correct statement, sir.
Gee,
now,
how many?
Did
how,
that,
oh my! Are you kidding?
I'd be hung.
And all you're asking for, listen, and Jim Feehan is the guest, the controversy in the 120th district. He lost by 13 votes, but again, there were some 75 voters of Bunnell that were given wrong ballots. Jim, all you're asking for, if I get you here, and I'm not the smartest guy in the field here, but if I get you, you're not looking for preferential treatment. You just want a free and fair election, a do-over either in the entire district or just Bunnell, because there's been an agreement that you got screwed here.
Well, that's all I'm asking for. And it's also for the people that I represented in the past. And you know the funny part about this? I don't mind if I would have lost clean. I wouldn't mind if I won clean. But this is not a clean election. It's tainted. And what's really terrible about this, my opponent, Mr. Young, you know what he said about the people that want a clean election?
What?
He called them pathetic. His own constituents on Facebook, he called them pathetic because we want a clean election. We've heard about this Russian meddling. We've heard about ballots lost in other communities in a city right next door to us. And then to call people pathetic because we want a free and untainted election, that's terrible.
Republican Jim Feehan is back with us for a few final moments. He and his attorneys have filed a petition with the U.S. Supreme Court regarding the lack of action the General Assembly's actually taken or not taken after they did take a vote that, okay, yeah, something screwy happened in his election at the polling place in Stratford. So, you know, reading up on this, Jim, you know, a lot of people are saying, you know, but you never know what the high court might do. A lot of people are saying that you may have no shot here because the state constitution is clear on this. But, you know, if the high court says no and the House Democrats and the majority party says no, I mean, that's sad. What redress do you have?
Well, Paul, I may not have a redress. That may just be the way the cookie crumbles, and there's nothing I can do about it. It is sad. And you know what? I lose, but you know what? We lose in Connecticut. The one basis we have on our democracy, on our republic, is quite simple, that elections should be fair. When we start skewing elections, This is a form of voter suppression. What do we say to people? They're going to say, why should I come out and vote? Because you're just going to do what you want anyway. Everybody wants to be treated fairly. That's the premise of elections. And right now, what the majority party is showing is that they don't want to have a fair election. They don't want to treat the people of Stratford properly. But you know what, Paul? There's three or four more days left in this session. I have a great hope that maybe Mr. Young, the Speaker of the House, maybe Mr. Ritter will find their conscience. You know, I wouldn't want to be Mr. Young because he has an asterisk after his name. And quite honestly, I think he should be ashamed to show his face in town.
You know, you have a scenario here. You know, Jim, the thing I see disappointing here that makes this all the more disappointing, shall I say, is that there's really no dispute here, correct, about what happened. You said that earlier, that there was an admission that improper ballots were given out. So nobody, correct me if I'm wrong here, but you're saying nobody is arguing that point, correct?
You are 100% correct. Can you imagine this? You have the Democratic Register of Voters, the Republican Register of Voters. You have the Democrats on this committee called the Contested House Committee. They agree this occurred. You have testimony. The Republicans on the committee agree this occurred. They're arguing about, or they can't come to consensus about, how to best handle this. Well, since you put me on the radio, which I appreciate, I offer this challenge to Mr. Young and the Democrats. They say I have almost no chance to win if we revoke Bunnell. They said they offered that. I've accepted it. I accepted it after the Connecticut Supreme Court, and on your show today, I'm accepting their challenge to revoke Bunnell. The question is, do they have the guts in the House to bring this up as a measure on the floor and keep their word that they all said they offered to us, which I never got any offer, by the way, I'm willing to revote just Bunnell. Are they?
So you will take a revote just for the Bunnell polling place for the 120th district seat. You don't want the whole district revoted. You'll take just Bunnell.
Of course. And you know what? I'm going to tell you, there's a 90% chance I'll lose because that was my highest polling location. I start down 250 votes in a special election, which anyone's going to tell you is almost impossible to get out, you know, a large amount of voters. Usually get anywhere from, you know, 5 to 15%. It's in the bag for them, and they won't even do that. I'm willing to do that just to close this and do it the right way. They won't even give me that much of a by your leave.
All right, Jim, thank you. What we'll do is I'll see if I can get anybody to respond and keep in touch, and we'll see what happens, all right?
Good luck. I've been trying to get him to respond, too.
All right. Thanks, Jim. Appreciate it there. Jim Feehan was the guest, and Jim wants a revote. He will take that of just Bunnell. He will take it, he says. He said it right here on Connecticut Today. He's willing to do that even if he loses, but he feels that because of the admitted mistake with the ballots back on November 13th, he is not being treated fairly right here in the Connecticut House District number 120. Going to shift gears now and talk about tobacco policy. Now, here in Connecticut, we are on the verge of raising the age to 21 that would allow folks to buy tobacco and tobacco-based products and vaping cartridges and all that. Joining us right now to talk about it is Dr. Brad Rodu. He is the endowed chair of tobacco harm reduction at the University of Louisville. Dr. Rodu, Paul here in Bridgeport, Connecticut. How are you, sir?
Good afternoon, Paul.
Well, you may have followed in the news that our General Assembly is just about to, well, they have passed a bill. It's apparently heading to our governor, Ned Lamont, to sign. The bill would raise the legal age to purchase tobacco products from 18 to 21. This got overwhelming bipartisan support. So, Doctor, this is really a trend we're starting to see now across the country.
That's right, Paul. There are about one-third of the states have now passed Tobacco 21 laws.
Why did this take so long, do you think? I mean, we always talk about 18 being an adult, but it seems that this has come on rather quickly all of a sudden. Would you say, Doctor, this has anything to do with the continued controversy now and the growth of these vaping products as well?
Well, it's certainly in part a reaction to that. And it's also, Paul, it's really getting at the main source of underage tobacco products. And that are the kids who are 18 and 19 years of age, mm-hmm. still in high school. 70 to 80% of underage kids say they get their tobacco products from their brothers, sisters, or older friends are legal purchasers.
Yeah, so you
so
have
this a, will you, shut that tap off.
Yeah, you have a kid who may be a senior in high school, 18, and then all of a sudden they can go in that local convenience store, right? And they get carded, the ID checks out, and all of a sudden maybe they get paid a few extra dollars from the younger younger guys and gals, and there you go.
There you go, exactly.
Dr. Roden, what do you say to folks who say, hey, listen, it's good, we understand the health issues here, but should somebody who is perhaps sent off to a war zone or somebody who does enlist in the military and is given a gun with the option to shoot or be killed, shouldn't they also be allowed to buy a legal tobacco product?
Well, I understand that argument, Paul, and I'm sensitive to it, but we have an all-volunteer army right now.
Mm-hmm.
So we let 18-year-olds make decisions about whether to join the service, whether to get married. We can decide as a society what ages we want to have for purchase of tobacco and alcohol and marijuana products. So I don't see that as a compelling argument. We elect legislators to make the tough decisions. And a lot of legislators in a lot of states have decided that they would prefer to have Tobacco 21 be their law. And I believe it will shut that tap off. I believe it's going to be a good policy to test.
And
we'll go from there.
And I also, Dr. Hefford, and like to get your thought on this, too. I've heard from other experts that say that, you know, there is new studies and new information that, in fact, the human brain in, let's say, a teenager who just may be at the high school graduation level, the development of the human brain actually is still going on from the high teens into perhaps the early 20s. Are you seeing and hearing that?
Well, let's put it this way. I don't want my children and your children to get addicted to any drug. That includes alcohol, marijuana, tobacco. I don't want that. Now, I find it a little bit exaggerated to say that alcohol irreversibly affects the teenage brain. And I'll tell you why. All of that research is based on mice.
Mm.
And I don't know about you, but I don't have any mice. Okay. So basically what you're saying, if you're saying that kind of exaggerated findings, is you're condemning all of the 40 million American adult smokers and about as many former smokers,
yeah,
that they have irreversible brain damage. And there is no human evidence that's ever documented that.
Interesting.
So I find that some of these arguments are a little bit exaggerated.
What are your thoughts regarding the vaping now, which, you know, now my son's a little older. He never did that. He never smoked. He's in his mid-20s now. But I am hearing, Dr. Rodu, from friends of mine who still have high school age students, boys and girls, I'm hearing from these moms and dads that I know that their own kids are telling them that the vaping they see in their own schools is out of control.
There's no question that vaping has increased among our teens, and it should be of concern. No one is, we're not going to accept drug use among our high school population. There's no question about that. Now, the question is, can we limit the products for teens without removing the access to those vastly safer nicotine and tobacco products, mm-hmm, among adult smokers who need them. That is their parents and grandparents who need to stop smoking. Vape products work for them, and we need to keep those adults accessible to them.
Yeah, it really is a double-edged sword, Dr. Rodu. And again, the guest is Dr. Brad Rodu, the endowed chair of tobacco harm reduction at the University of Louisville. Yeah, I mean, I personally worked in the radio business, doctor, with a woman who was in pretty good health, but she was a habitual smoker. She had tried everything she could. This is a few years ago when the e-cigarettes first came out. And within probably about a week, literally, she had stopped using tobacco. Now, she was vaping like crazy, but she said she tried anything and everything. And yeah, you're right, they're not the best thing in the world. But, you know, these e-cigarettes, you know, vaping, the liquid nicotine, it does work for a lot of people.
It sure does, Paul. And I've spent my 40-year career in major cancer centers. I've seen the toll personally that smoking can take mm-hmm. on smokers who are unable or unwilling to give up nicotine and tobacco entirely. So these vape products, there's no question. Don't take it from me. Take it from the British Royal College of Physicians, one of the oldest and most prestigious medical societies, when they tell you that vaping long-term is unlikely to be any more than 5% as hazardous as smoking.
Yeah, and listen, you know, we talk about, as you just said, Dr. Rodu, we talk about alcohol and things like marijuana and other drugs, but, man, I have never even lit up a conventional cigarette. You know, I've tried marijuana mm-hmm. in the past. I've smoked an occasional cigar here and there, but, boy, I got to tell you, from what I hear from people and what people I know, boy, the addictive properties of nicotine, wow. I mean, I've had experts tell me it could be the worst one out there.
Well, certainly nicotine is addictive.
Yeah.
But there's no more powerful way to get your nicotine than through smoking. And so we have to move people away from the fire because smoke creates 7,000 chemicals. And a career of that is ultimately going to lead to cancers, heart disease and stroke, and emphysema. Whereas vapor is much simpler chemically. It's water, it's a nicotine, and it's some carrier, and it's a little flavor. And it's so vastly safer that we have to keep that those products accessible to smokers.
Hey, Dr. Rodu, final question here in about the minute and a half we have left. What if there are people listening to us right now who have sons, daughters, grandsons, granddaughters who, you know, may be smoking or vaping and they may be 19 or 20 or 18 and now they're going to get, it'll be a little tougher for them, if not impossible, to get stuff until they're 21. What would you say to them if they're really upset and scared and wondering, no matter what the mode of delivery for nicotine is, to their young grandkids or kids? What should they say? How could they handle that? How afraid should they be?
One word, all smoke free. If you're going to get your nicotine and tobacco, don't get it by burning it and inhaling the smoke. When you cut out the smoke, you cut out almost all of the risk. And so that would be the word that I would tell. That would be the thing that I would tell everybody mm-hmm. is step away from the smoke.
Interesting and simple. Dr. Brad Rodu, endowed chair of tobacco harm reduction in the University of Louisville. Boy, doctor, I got to give you credit. You're chairing tobacco harm reduction right in the middle of tobacco country down there. Are you hissed at when you walk up and down the street or not?
Well, Paul, I was recruited here because Kentucky has one of the highest lung cancer rates in the country, and we're trying to move people away from that. And anybody can check out my work at Rodu Tobacco Truth blog.
Okay, that's Rodu, R-O-D-U, Tobacco Truth blog. Doctor, thank
exactly.
you. We really appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Thanks for your time, Paul.
Thanks. Bye-bye.